Laura?
Yes.
Mother was getting anxious. Was it all right?
Yes, quite. Oh, Laurie!
She took his arm. She pressed up against him.
I say, you're not crying, are you?
Asked her brother. Laura shook her head. She was. Laurie put his arm round her shoulder.
Don't cry, he said in his warm, loving voice. Was it awful?
No,
sobbed Laura.
It was simply marvelous. But Laurie...
She stopped. She looked at her brother.
Isn't life...
She stammered.
Isn't life...
But what life was, she couldn't explain. No matter. He quite understood. Isn't it, darling? Said Laurie. What a terrific story. If you have any aspirations to fiction writing, the perfection of this story has to inspire awe and envy. Before the questions, a bit of background. Catherine Mansfield was a writer who came from New Zealand, although she spent her adult years in England. She was married to John Middleton Murray, a writer and critic, was friends with D.H. and Frieda Lawrence. In fact, she was the model, at least in part, for Gudrun in his Women in Love, produced a sizable handful of very lovely and accomplished stories, and died young of tuberculosis. Despite her slim output, there are those who would rank her as one of the unquestioned masters of the short story form. The story, printed here, appeared in 1922, the year before she died. It is not autobiographical in any ways that matter for our purposes. So, are you ready for those questions? First question, what does the story signify? What is Mansfield saying in the story? What do you see it as meaning? Second question, how does it signify? What elements does Mansfield employ to cause the story to signify whatever it signifies? What elements, in other words, cause it to mean the things you take it to mean? Okay, here are the ground rules. 1. Read carefully. 2. Use any interpretive strategies you've picked up from this book or elsewhere. 3. Employ no outside sources about the story. 4. No peeking at the rest of this chapter. 5. Write down your results so there's no fudging. Neatness doesn't count, nor spelling, just observations. Give the story careful thought and record your results. Then bring them back here and we'll compare notes. Take as long as you like. Oh, you're back. That didn't take too long. Not too arduous, I hope. What I've done in the meantime is handed out to a few college students of my acquaintance, some of them veterans of my classes, some of them close relatives who owe me a favor. I'll give you 3 different versions and you can see if they sound familiar. The first, a college freshman, said, I know that story. We read it junior year. It's the one about a rich family that lives up on a hill and has no clue about the working class that's trapped down in the valley. This is pretty much what all my respondents noticed. So far, so good. The beauty of this story is that everybody gets it. You feel what's important in it, see the tensions of family and class. The second, a history major, who has taken several of my courses, expanded on that initial assessment a bit. To have the party or not, that is the question. An element of indifference is the ultimate overtone. These things happen. How could we not celebrate? For our main character, her guilt is heightened by the fact that these mourners live down the hill. It is brought to extremes when, at the end of the party, it is suggested that, in an act of goodwill and charity, those below should be given the leftovers. What does this signify? The indifference of the dominant class of people to the suffering of others. Our main character is somewhere in between, caught between what is expected of her and how she feels. She faces it. She takes the food, the waste of the party, to the widow in mourning. She faces the horrible reality of humanity. Afterward, she seeks the comfort of the only person who could possibly understand the situation, her brother, and finds no answers because there are no answers, just shared perceptions of reality.
That's pretty good. A number of themes are beginning to emerge.
Both of these first 2 readings have picked up what is most central to the story. Namely, the growing awareness of the main character to class differentiation and snobbery. Consider the third response.
The writer, Diane, is a recent graduate who took several classes from me in both literature and creative writing. Here's what she said. What does the story signify? Mansfield's The Garden Party shows the clash between the social classes. More specifically, it shows how people insulate themselves from what lies outside their own narrow view of the world, how to put up blinders, be they with velvet ribbons, if you will. How does it signify? Birds and flight. Mansfield uses the metaphor of birds and flight as a strategy to show how the Sheridans insulate themselves from the lower classes. Joe's is a butterfly. Mrs. Sheridan's voice floats, and Laura must skim over the lawn, up the path, up the steps, to reach her. They are all perched high on an aerie, up a steep rise from the cottages below. But Laura is a fledgling. Her mother steps back and encourages her to flit around in her preparations for the party, but Laura's wings aren't quite experienced enough. She flung her arms over her head, took a deep breath, stretched, and let them fall, then sighed, so that even a workman smiled down at her. From her vantage on the ground, Laura still has a foot in their lower-class world. They are her neighbors. She has not yet separated herself from them. Remote sympathy is fine, but intimate empathy directly conflicts with the Sheridan's manner of living. If Laura is to rise to the level of her family and class, then she is going to need instruction. Like her siblings before her, she learns from her mother. Mrs. Sheridan teaches Laura how to put on a garden party, but more to the point, she teaches the strategy to see the world from a loftier, though somewhat myopic, perspective. Like a mother bird teaching her young to fly, Mrs. Sheridan encourages Laura to go so far on her own until it becomes clear that her inexperience requires intervention. When Laura pleads with her mother to cancel the party because of the Carter's death, Mrs. Sheridan diverts her with a gift of a new hat. Though Laura is reluctant to abandon her base instincts, she does manage a compromise. "I'll remember it again after the party's over." She chooses to put a little space between her life on the hill and the outside world. Laura sees her peers, her fellow partygoers, as birds that had alighted in the Sheridan's garden for this one afternoon on their way to where? The answer is left vague. There is a danger below at the cottages of the lower classes. When the Sheridan children were young, they were forbidden to set foot there. A man down there has a house front studded all over with minute bird cages. Those cages represent a threat to the way of life of the high-flying birds of the social elite. As long as they remain aloft, they evade the danger. But it is now time for Laura to try her wings. Mrs. Sheridan pushes her from the nest. She tells her to go down to the cottages to give the widow a sympathy basket of their leftovers. Laura must confront her conflict between the world view that nags at her and the more slivered view of her advantaged upbringing. She faces her conscience. She goes down from the safety of her home, crosses the broad road to the cottages, and becomes caged in the house of the dead man. She becomes self-conscious of her appearance, shiny and streaming, something apart from the people who live here. She sees herself through the eyes of the young widow, and is confused that the woman does not know why Laura has come. She begins to recognize that her world does not belong here, and the realization frightens her. She wants to flee, but she must ultimately view the dead man. It is while looking at him that she chooses to see, instead of the reality of the hardship the man's death leaves to his family, an affirmation of her own lifestyle. She reasons that his death has nothing at all to do with garden parties and baskets and lace frocks, and she is thereby lifted from moral obligation. The revelation is marvelous. If Laura cannot explain what life is to her brother, isn't life? It is because, as Mansfield writes, it is of no matter. Laura has learned to look at it from a loftier perspective. She needn't pretend to look short-sighted anymore.
Wow. I'd like to say I taught her everything she knows, but that would be a lie. She never got those insights from me. In fact, that's not the primary direction my reading tends. But if it were, I don't believe I could improve upon it.
It's neat, carefully observant, fully realized, elegantly expressed, if obviously the product of a much more intense study of the text than I had asked you to undertake. In fact, as a group, the student observations I solicited were on the money. If your response was like any of them, give yourself an A. If we express the act of reading in scientific or religious terms, since I'm not sure if this will fall into the realm of physics or metaphysics, all these student readings represent, with varying degrees of specificity and depth, almost clinical analysis of the observable phenomena of the story. This is as it should be. Readers need to deal with the obvious, and not-so-obvious, material of the story before going anywhere else. The most disastrous readings are those that are wildly inventive and largely independent of the story's factual content, those that go riffing off on a word out of context, or a supposed image that is in truth not at all the image presented in the text. What I want to do, on the other hand, is consider the noumenal level of the story, its spiritual or essential level of being. If you don't think such a thing is possible, neither does my spell checker, but here we go. This is an exercise in feeling my way into the text. I'll be honest here. I'm about to cheat. I asked you to tell me what the story signifies first, but for my own response, I'm going to hold that for last. It's more dramatic that way. Way back, I mentioned that Joyce's Ulysses makes heavy use of Homer's tale of long-suffering Odysseus wending his way home from Troy. You may recall that I also mentioned that, except for the title, there are almost no textual clues to suggest that these Homeric parallels are at work in the novel. That's a pretty big level of signification to hang on one word, even a very prominent one. Well, if you can do that with a title of an immense novel, why not with a little story? The Garden Party. Now, all the student respondents worked with it too, chiefly with its last word. Me, I like the middle one. I like looking at gardens and thinking about them. For years, I've lived next to one of the great agricultural universities, and its campus is a giant garden filled with a number of spectacular smaller gardens. Every one of those gardens, and every garden that's ever been, is on some level an imperfect copy of another garden, the paradise in which our first parents lived. So when I see a garden in a story or poem, the first thing I do is to see how well it fits that Edenic template, and I must admit that in Mansfield's story, the fit is also imperfect. That's okay, though, because the story from Genesis of Adam and Eve is only one version, and on the level of myth, it has many cousins. For now, I think I'll reserve judgment for a little bit about what sort of garden this particular one might turn out to be. What I notice first in the text is that word ideal. How many times have you described your weather as ideal? They couldn't have had a more perfect day. Those two words may just be hyperbole, but coming in the first two sentences of the story, they feel suggestive. The sky is without a cloud, just so we can't but expect some sort of cloud is coming, and the gardener has been at work since dawn. Later, this perfect afternoon will ripen and then slowly fade, as a fruit or flower would. By then, we will have seen that flowers permeate this story, as befits a garden party. Even the places emptied of daisies are rosettes, and the real roses themselves have bloomed in the hundreds overnight, as if by magic, or since Mansfield mentions a visitation by archangels, by divinity. This first paragraph is bracketed by the ideal and archangels. Not a particularly human environment, is it? When I see an unreal, idealized setting such as this, I generally want to know who's in charge. No mystery here. Everyone defers to Mrs. Sheridan. Whose garden is it? Not the gardener's. He's just a servant doing the bidding of the mistress. And what a garden, with its hundreds of roses, lily lawn, caraca trees with broad leaves and bunches of yellow fruit, lavender, plus trays and trays and trays of canna lilies, of which Mrs. Sheridan believes one cannot have too many. This excess of canna lilies she describes as enough for once in her life. Even the guests become part of her garden realm, seeming to be bright birds as they stroll the lawn and stoop to admire the flowers, while her hat, which she passes on to Laura, has gold daisies,
Clearly, she is the queen, or goddess of this garden world. Food is the other major element of her realm. She is responsible for food for the party. Sandwiches, 15 different kinds, including cream cheese and lemon curd, and egg and olive, and cream puffs and passion fruit ices, so we know it is New Zealand and not Newcastle. The final component is children, of which she has four. So, a queen overseeing her realm of living plants, food, and progeny. Mrs. Sheridan begins to sound suspiciously like a fertility goddess. Since, however, there are lots of kinds of fertility goddesses, we need more information. I'm not done with that hat. It's a black hat with black velvet ribbon and gold daisies, equally incongruous at the party and at the later visitation, although I'm less impressed by what it is than by whose it is. Mrs. Sheridan has purchased it, but she insists that Laura take it, declaring it much too young for herself. Although Laura resists, she does accept the hat and is later captivated by her own charming image in the mirror. No doubt she does look charming, but part of that is transferal. When a younger character takes on an older character's talisman, she also assumes some of the elder's power. This is true whether it's a father's coat, a mentor's sword, a teacher's pen, or a mother's hat. Because the hat has come from Mrs. Sheridan, Laura instantly becomes more closely associated than any of her siblings with her mother. This identification is furthered first by Laura standing beside her mother to help with the goodbyes, and then by the contents of her charity basket, leftover food from the party and, but for the destruction they would have wrought on her lace frock, arum lilies. This growing identification between Mrs. Sheridan and Laura is significant on a couple of levels, and we'll return to that presently. First, though, let's look at Laura's trip. The perfect afternoon on the high promontory is ending and growing dusky as Laura shuts their garden gates. From here on her trip grows progressively darker. The cottages down in the hollow are in deep shade, the lane smoky and dark. Some of the cottages show a flicker of light, just enough to project shadows on the windows. She wishes she had put on a coat, since her bright frock shines amid the dismal surroundings. Inside the dead man's house itself, she goes down a gloomy passage to a kitchen lighted by a smoky lamp. When her visit ends, she makes her way past all those dark people to a spot where her brother Laurie steps out of the shadow. There are a couple of other odd features here. For one thing, on her way to the lane, Laura is gratuitously accosted by a large dog running by like a shadow. Upon getting to the bottom, she crosses the broad road to go into the dismal lane. Once in the lane, there's an old woman with a crutch sitting with her feet on newspaper. On her way in and out, Laura passes individuals and small knots of shadowy figures, but they don't speak to her, and the one by the old woman, she alone speaks, parts to make way for her. When the old woman says the house is indeed that of the dead man, she smiles queerly. Although Laura hasn't wanted to see the dead man, when the sheets are folded back, she finds him wonderful, beautiful, echoing her admiration in the morning for the workman who stoops to pick and smell the lavender. Laurie, it turns out, has come to wait at the end of the lane, almost as if he can't enter because Mother was getting quite anxious. What just happened here? For one thing, as my student respondents note, Laura has seen how the other half lives and dies. One major point of the story is unquestionably the confrontation she has with the lower class and the challenge that meeting throws at her easy class assumptions and prejudices. And then there is the story of a young girl growing up, part of which involves seeing her first dead man. But I think something else is going on here. I think Laura has just gone to hell. Hades, actually, the classical underworld, the realm of the dead. Not only that, she hasn't gone as Laura Sheridan, but as Persephone. I know what you're thinking. Now he's lost his mind. It wouldn't be the first time, and probably not the last. Persephone's mother is Demeter, the goddess of agriculture, fertility, and marriage. Agriculture, fertility, marriage, food, flowers, children. Does that sound like anyone we know?
Remember, the guests admiring the flowers at Mrs. Sheridan's garden party go about in couples, as if she has in some way been responsible for their pairing off, so marriage is in there. Okay, the long version is in Chapter 19, but here's the lightning round version. Fertility goddess mother, beautiful daughter, kidnap and seduction by god of underworld, permanent winter, pomegranate seed monkey business, 6 month growing season, happy parties all round. What we get here, of course, is the myth explaining the seasons in agricultural fertility, and what sort of culture would it be that didn't have a myth to cover that? Highly remiss in my book. But that's not the only thing this myth covers. There's the business of the young woman arriving at adulthood, and this constitutes a huge step, since it involves facing and comprehending death. The myth involves the tasting of the fruit, as with Eve, and the stories share the initiation into adult knowledge. With Eve, too, the knowledge gained is of our mortality, and while that's not quite the point of the Persephone story, it's sort of unavoidable when she marries the CEO of the Land of the Dead. So how does that make Laura into Persephone, you ask? First, there's her mother as Demeter. That one is, as I suggested, pretty obvious, once the flowers and food and children and couples are considered. Moreover, we should recall that they live on this Olympian height, towering geographically and in class terms over the ordinary mortals in the hollow below. In this divine world, the summer's day is perfect, ideal, as the world was before the loss of her daughter plunged Demeter into mourning and outrage. Then there is the trip down the hill and into a self-contained world full of shadows and smoke and darkness. She crosses the broad road as if it were the river Styx, which one has to cross to enter Hades. No entry is possible without two things. One must pass by Cerberus, the three-headed dog who stands guard, and one must have the admission ticket, Aeneas's golden bough. Oh, and a guide wouldn't hurt. Laura has her confrontation with the dog just outside her garden gate, and her golden bough turns out to be the gold daisies on her hat. As for guides, and no traveler to the underworld should be without one, Dante, in the Divine Comedy, 1321 AD, has the Roman poet Virgil. In Virgil's epic, the Aeneid, 19 BC, Aeneas has the Cumaean Sibyl as his guide. Laura's Sibyl is that very old woman with a queer smile. Her manner is no stranger than that of the Cumaean version, and the newspaper under her feet suggests the oracles written on leaves in the Sibyl's cave, where, when the visitor entered, winds whipped the leaves around, scrambling the messages. Aeneas is told to only accept the message from her own lips. As for the knot of unspeaking people who make way for Laura, every visitor to the lower world finds that the shadows pay him or her very little mind, the living having nothing to offer those whose living is done. Admittedly, these elements of the trip to Hades are not native to the Persephone myth, but they have become part and parcel of our understanding of such a trip. Her admiration for the deceased man's form, her identification with the grieving wife, and her audible sob all suggest a symbolic marriage. That world is dangerous, though. Her mother has started to warn her before she sets out, as Demeter warns her daughter against eating anything in some versions of the original. Moreover, Mrs. Sheridan sends Lori, a latter-day Hermes, to escort Laura back from this world of the dead. Okay, so why all this business from 3 or 4,000 years ago? That's what you're wondering, right? There are a couple of reasons, it seems to me, or perhaps a couple of major ones out of many possibilities. Remember, as many commentators have said about the Persephone myth, it encompasses the youthful female experience, the archetypal acquisition of knowledge of sexuality and of death. Our entry into adulthood, the myth suggests, depends on our understanding of our sexual natures and of our mortality. These modes of knowledge are part of Laura's day in the story. She admires the workmen, comparing them favorably to the young men who come to Sunday supper, presumably as prospective beaux for one or another of the sisters, and later she finds the dead man beautiful, a response encompassing both sex and death. Her inability at the very end of the story to articulate what life is as caught in the repeated fragment of speech, isn't life, suggests an involvement with death so strong that she cannot at this moment formulate any statement about life. This pattern of entry into adult life, Mansfield intimates, has been a recognizable part of our culture for thousands of years. Of course, it has always been there, but the myth embodying the archetype has continued unbroken through Western culture since the very early Greeks. In tapping into this ancient tale of initiation, she invests the story of Laura's initiation with the accumulated power of the prevailing myth. The second reason is perhaps less exalted. When Persephone returns from the underworld, she has, in a sense, become her mother. In fact, some Greek rituals did not distinguish between mother and daughter. That may be a good thing if your mother is really Demeter, less so if she is Mrs. Sheridan. In wearing her mother's hat and carrying her basket, she also takes on her mother's views. Although Laura struggles against the unconscious arrogance of her family throughout the story, she cannot finally break away from their Olympian attitudes toward the merely mortal who reside below the hill. That she is relieved to be rescued by Lori, even though she has found the experience marvelous, suggests that her efforts to become her own person have been only partially successful. We must surely recognize our own incomplete autonomy in hers, for how many of us can deny that there is a great deal of our parents, for good or ill, in us? What if you don't see all this going on in the story? If you read it simply as a narrative of a young woman making an ill-advised trip on which she learns something about her world, if you don't see Persephone or Eve or any other mythic figures in the imagery? The modernist poet Ezra Pound said that a poem has to work first of all on the level of the reader for whom a hawk is simply a hawk. The same goes for stories. An understanding of the story in terms of what literally happens, if the story is as good as this one, is a great starting point. From there, if you consider the pattern of images and allusions, you'll begin to see more going on. Your conclusions may not resemble mine or Diane's, but if you're observing carefully and meditating on the possibilities, you'll reach valid conclusions of your own that will enrich and deepen your experience of the story. So what does the story signify then? Many things. It offers a critique of the class system, a story of initiation into the adult world of sex and death, an amusing examination of family dynamics, and a touching portrait of a child struggling to establish herself as an independent entity in the face of nearly overwhelming parental influence. What else could we ask of a simple little story? Envoi. There's a very old tradition in poetry of adding a little stanza, shorter than the rest, at the end of a long narrative poem or sometimes a book of poems. The function differed from poem to poem. Sometimes it was a very brief summation or conclusion. My favorite was the apology to the poem itself. Well, little book, you're not that much, but you're the best I could make you. Now you'll just have to make your way in the world as best you can. Fare thee well. This ritual sending off was called the envoi. I told you that all the best terms are French, and the worst, meaning more or less to send off on a mission. If I told you that I didn't owe my book an apology, we'd both know it was untrue. And every author wraps up a manuscript with some trepidation as to its future welfare. That trepidation, however, becomes pointless once the manuscript becomes a book, as the old writers understood, which is why they told the poor book that it was now an orphan, that whatever parental protections the writer could offer had ended. On the other hand, I figure my little enterprise can get along without me pretty well, so I'll spare it the send-off. Instead, I would address my envoi to the reader. You've really been very good about all this, very sporting. You've borne my guff and my wisecracks and my annoying mannerisms much better than I have any right to expect. A first-class audience, really. Now that it's time for us to part, I have a few thoughts with which to send you on your way. First, a confession and a warning. If I have given the impression somehow, by reaching an endpoint, for instance, that I have exhausted the codes by which literature is written and understood, I must apologize. It simply isn't true. In fact, we've only scratched the surface here. It now strikes me as highly peculiar, for instance, that I could have brought you this far with no mention of fire. It's one of the original four elements, along with water, earth, and air, yet somehow it didn't come up in our discussion. There are dozens of other topics we could have addressed as easily and as profitably as the ones we did. In fact, my original conception was for somewhat fewer chapters and a slightly different lineup. The chapters that wound up getting included reflect the noisiness and persistence of their topics. Some ideas refused to be denied, crowding their way in and sometimes crowding out those that were less ill-mannered. Looking back over the text, it strikes me as highly idiosyncratic. To the extent that my colleagues would agree that this mode of reading is at least a strong part of what we do, they would no doubt squawk over my categories. Quite right, too. Every professor will have a unique set of emphases. I gather my thoughts into groupings that seem inevitable, but different groupings or formulations may seem inevitable to someone else. What this book represents is not a database of all the cultural codes by which writers create and readers understand the products of that creation, but a template, a pattern, a grammar of sorts from which you can learn to look for those codes on your own. No one could include them all, and no reader would want to plow through the resulting encyclopedia. I'm pretty sure I could have made this book with not too much effort twice as long. I'm also pretty sure neither of us wants that. Second, a felicitation. All those other codes, you don't need them. At least, you don't need them all spelled out. There comes a point in anyone's reading where watching for pattern and symbol becomes almost second nature, where words and images start calling out for attention. Consider the way Diane picked up on the birds in the garden party. No one taught her to go looking for birds per se in her reading. Rather, what happens is that, based on other reading experiences in a variety of courses and contexts, she learned to watch for distinctive features of a text, for repetitions of a certain kind of object or activity, for resonances. One mention of birds or flight is an occurrence, two may be a coincidence, but three constitutes a definite trend. And trends, as we know, cry out for examination. You can figure out fire. Or horses. Characters in stories have ridden horses and sometimes bemoaned their absence for thousands of years. What does it mean to be mounted on a horse, as opposed to being on foot? Consider some examples. Diomedes in Odysseus stealing the Thracian horses in the Iliad. The Lone Ranger waving from astride the rearing silver. Richard III crying out for a horse. Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda roaring down the road on their choppers in Easy Rider. Any three or four examples will do. What do we understand about horses and riding them or driving them? Or not? See, you can do it just fine. Third, some suggestions. In the appendix, I offer some ideas for further reading. There's nothing systematic or even particularly orderly about the suggestions. I'm certainly not weighing in on the culture wars, offering a prescribed reading list to make you whatever. Mostly these are works I've mentioned along the way, works I like and admire for a variety of reasons, works I think you might like as well. I hope you'll find them even better now than you would have a number of pages ago. My main suggestion, though, is to read things you like. You're not stuck with my list. Go to your bookstore or library and find novels, poems, plays, stories that engage your imagination and your intelligence. Read great literature, by all means, but read good writing. Much of what I like best in my reading I found by accident as I poked around bookshelves. And don't wait for writers to be dead to be read. The living ones can use the money. Your reading should be fun. We only call them literary works. Really, though, it's all a form of play. So, play, dear reader, play. And fare thee well. In the appendix on the PDF that accompanies this program, I offer some ideas for further reading. This is David DeVries. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged recording of How to Read Literature Like a Professor. A lively and entertaining guide to reading between the lines. by Thomas C. Foster. This program was produced by Listen Up Audiobooks. The director was Chris Fogg. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2003 by Thomas C. Foster. Production copyright 2012 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. The excerpts from James Joyce's The Dead from Dubliners, The Modern Library, 1969. Catherine Mansfield's The Garden Party from The Garden Party and Other Stories, Alfred A. Knopf, 1922. The excerpt from Elizabeth Bishop's The Fish by permission of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, Inc. The excerpt from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland by permission of Faber and Faber Limited. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.